Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
So how did the media fare this past year? NPR's David Folkenflik joins us about every week to chew over all matters media, and he has some thoughts to close out this year and launch the new one. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. David, happy almost New Year.
Thanks so much. You too.
And how was the last one for the industry you follow? Lots of different topics. What do you think? Well, let's start with, the negative. You know, what was the media's most serious failure in 2014?
Right. Well, sometimes it's most instructive to study the failures of something to figure out how things might work well. In this case, I think there's a common theme to some of the most striking failures of the past year, and that was in the ability of the press to report on serious stories of allegations of violence against women. Think of Ray Rice and the Baltimore Ravens, a case in which we had video of him dragging his now wife out of an elevator, and people said, well, it was a minor domestic squabble. It wasn't until we saw the video posted by TMZ in late summer of him actually striking her that people started to take that seriously. Yeah. Think of Bill Cosby, somebody about whom stories had been written as far back as 2005 of allegations that he had sexually violated a woman that he had known at Temple University. And people had sort of let that go. He was America's sitcom father, a beloved figure. And yet reporters and even a prominent biographer, Mark Whitaker, formerly of NBC News and Newsweek magazine and other places, you know, had basically given him a pass. In fact, in Whitaker's case, gave him a total pass. He's going back now to add chapters to that book about all these now couple dozen allegations against Bill Cosby. And then there's another one I think that's gotten less attention in the U.S. but consumed Canada. The CBC former host, Jean Gomeshi, faces criminal charges after a series of allegations posted by the Toronto Star that he had not only harassed a former colleague but actually had physically choked and assaulted women that he had dated in the past.
Well, but then there's also the Rolling Stone University of Virginia story.
And I think that's perhaps the most epic systemic fail of all, a publication that raised so many serious questions about the culture at the University of Virginia, but really pinned it squarely on an anecdote in which they not only did not give those accused, even if by pseudonyms, of a gang rape the chance to respond, but didn't even go to the effort of talking to those friends of the accuser to try to verify elements of her story. It was said to be done at her behest, but it was their failure at Rolling Stone and not the woman's failure, regardless of what ultimately the merits of her accusations proved to be.
Okay, a little bit of taking to the woodshed there by David Folkenflik. But the media had tremendous successes in the past year. Podcasts became tremendously successful. One in particular I know you want to talk about that made headlines, and that's Serial. It's the podcast that told just one story of the 1999 murder of a young high schooler Hay Lynn. Adnan Syed was convicted and imprisoned, and host Sarah Koenig did the investigation and told the story. Let's listen to just a little.
And on paper, the case was like a Shakespearean mashup. Young lovers from different worlds, thwarting their families, secret assignations, jealousy, suspicion, and honor besmirched. The villain, not a Moor exactly, but a Muslim all the same. And a final act of murderous revenge. In the main stage, a regular old high school, across the street from a 7-Eleven.
David Folkenflik, why, first of all, do you think this was so popular?
It reminded us of how transporting and how intimate audio can be. Part of the charm of Serial was that not only was it told episodically, but she was doing some of the reporting as the narrative progressed. And so she really was allowing us to discover things seemingly as she was herself, although there was some scrambling of chronology, I think, in when things were reported as they were presented to the listener. Very powerful thing. So it both told us a little bit about the power of audio and of storytelling, and it told us of the power of narrative as well.
Well, I'm going to jump off something that you said, that it reminded us. You said that too. And I know a lot of storytellers, documentary filmmakers who have spent years in the trenches who said, geez, I've been doing this kind of thing for years. Maybe I should just split it up into stories over several weeks and people will think it's something new.
let's not forget, Charles Dickens got his start serializing his novels. They were told in these feuilletons, this little incremental chapters, and people would rush to printers or stores or wherever they could get their hands on it. I believe that in the U.S., people would rush to the docks as the ships came in carrying them with the updates to see what had happened to his characters, to Little Nell, to Oliver Twist, to somebody else. This carried some of that power. You had over 2 million people participate as listeners. And think about this. It's not just happening to turn on your radio. You are actively downloading these podcasts. So you are consciously deciding to take part in this. And I think it is tapping into an oral history. I think it is tapping into something that documentary makers, whether audio or video documentary makers as well, know, which is the power of people telling their own stories, of hearing those voices. It also raised some questions of the journalistic choices. A key character, Jay, who is the person who implicates Adnan to police and then, you know, clearly helping to convince a jury to convict him in the young woman's murder. Jay was not interviewed on tape. Jay spoke at the very end on the record but off tape, and his full name was not used. In the last couple of days, the website The Intercept did interview him by name and on the record. It does suggest one reservation I heard from a number of former top news executives at other institutions was they would have liked her to have completed her reporting before she started actually podcasting and presenting the episodes, because they felt that was a missing element. And here it was, just a couple days after its conclusions, showing up somewhere else.
Well, you mentioned The Intercept. That's the online media outlet under the parent company First Look Media. It launched early in the year. It had reporters like Glenn Greenwald. Again, it has this interview with Jay. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. But how would you characterize Intercept's success outside of that headline-making interview?
Well, as you say, Glenn Greenwald, he along with lawyer Poitras and the Washington Post's Barton Gellman shared a Pulitzer last spring for their work on the NSA and Snowden documents, really exposing the extent to which surveillance had taken place in this country and abroad. And Greenwald wanted even more liberty. He had to embrace an adversarial form of journalism that he felt even at The Guardian, which has taken on, I think, with real bravery, government agencies in the UK and the U.S., he said First Look Media would offer him that. It's billionaire founder Omidyar, you know, a lot of money, a lot of talent being hired in. I think they've had almost no impact over the past year. They launched early in 2014. They said, look, it's all beta at the moment. We're just figuring it out. And maybe that led to too great an expectation or burden being placed on them by people externally. But when you hire people like Glenn Greenwald, you expect some rather incendiary results.
Well, and what about the warfare over former reporter Matt Taibbi?
Well, right. Once and current Rolling Stone writer Matt Taibbi, he joined First Look Media to create a vertical that would focus on how the financial game is rigged, as he would put it, the secrets of how Wall Street works and how finance works. And in fact, the most striking journalism done by First Look over the past year in many ways was its own accounts of its internal strife, how Taibbi clashed with people above him. And part of this is when you hire people who are bomb throwers, even if rhetorical bomb throwers, they can find it difficult to work inside a hierarchy. And part of it was that it really has not been entirely clear what Pierre Omidyar exactly wants this company of his to do. And even though he's hired a lot of talented people, it comes through. And it's not clear how well this will ever get off the ground. I think 2015 is going to be a tough challenge for them.
Well, whatever happens, NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik will be with us to look at it. David, thanks so much.
You bet. And best for the new year.
To you too.